Welcome to the rain and the news on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Parking is at such a premium in Seattle. In Ballard, the Salmon Bay Eagles Club is finding that out. The Eagles are a social club that raises money for charity. Now, its across-the-street neighbor, the Olympic Athletic Club, would like to buy a piece of land owned by the Eagles and turn that into a parking garage. Next month, Eagles members will vote on whether to sell the property to Olympic for $2.4 million. According to the president of the Eagles Club, James Forgette, the athletic club is engaging in some unethical tactics to stack that vote toward selling.
They're simply asking their members to come over and join our club for the purposes of voting on the sale of this property. And many of us take exception to that and don't believe that's why people should be joining the Eagles. You know, there's a flyer from Olympic Athletic Club they have been giving out to their members that simply states, in so many words, we want you to join the Eagles across the street and help us vote for the sale of this property to us so we can build this parking garage and then everyone can have parking.
What is that like to be in this small social club and now you have members who are technically members but you don't feel like they're really members of the family? What does that do to your club?
It changes the entire dynamics of the club. We've got a lot of new members, but you don't know any of the members. So it's just become very contentious at the club. It's become very political, and it's unfortunate because I think for some people, just going to the club isn't something they want to do anymore.
Olympic Athletic Club is offering you some pretty good money for this piece of land, $2.4 million. Why not sell it to them?
Well, that's a really good question, and you know, that might be the right thing to do at the end of the day, is to sell it. And there's some members who think it is the right thing to do. But I don't feel like we have done a good job of moving this forward and involving our membership so that they fully understand what is going on and what our options are if we don't sell. What are our options if we don't sell? And do we need to sell? And where are our finances at the club right now? What position is the club in financially in terms of should we sell? Should we hold on to it? If we do sell, what do we do with that money? It's $2.4 million. That's a lot of money. What do we do with it? How is it managed? Who manages it? All of those questions. And I don't think our members or myself have really gotten clear, concise answers about that. And that concerns me because that's a lot of money.
Right. That's kind of the bigger picture, the bigger story here, isn't it? Is how valuable this little piece of property is?
I think so. I think it's the sign of the times in this city. If you look around Ballard, I mean, all you see is building. And if you look down at South Lake Union and everywhere else, all you see is cranes. I mean, right now, if you own a piece of property in Seattle, you know, you can write your ticket, or so it seems.
So you looked into whether you could just change your bylaws to freeze these new athletic club members out. That can't happen, apparently. So I've heard that some of your members are recruiting in the other direction.
Yes, I believe some are recruiting in the other direction.
How does that go?
Well, I think there's been a genuine grassroots upswell in the neighborhood, people hearing about this, and you know, they just kind of look at it from the outside looking in and go, that's not right.
So suddenly anybody with an opinion on your story can become an Eagles member just to weigh in. Must be good for membership.
It has been good for membership. I mean, it's been good for membership, and it necessarily hasn't been so good for membership. I mean, I was just told we have more members than we've had since the early 70s. However, one of the concerns, of course, is we don't want people joining the Eagles just so they can vote on this sale. We want people joining the Eagles because they want to be part of the Eagles, and they want to be part of this club. club and they want to, you know, give back to the community and raise money for charity and enjoy and have fun doing it and meeting new people. I mean, you know, that's what the club is all about. And unfortunately, right now, it's all about the sale of this property.
That's James Forget, the president of the Salmon Bay Eagles Club in Ballard. Now, with the other side of the story is the owner of Olympic Athletic Club. Jim Riggle says he's been an Eagles member himself for about 8 years. And Riggle says he is encouraging athletic club members to join the Eagles, but he's not telling them how to vote. Riggle says he doesn't need to do that because this is such a good deal for everyone.
The property that we're looking at purchasing is the service station, which has 6 gasoline tanks on it, all of which are leaking, that it needs to be cleaned up. And we propose to do that for them and then turn the site into a above-ground parking garage with approximately 400 cars.
Well, some of their members do want to sell to you. Some of them don't. But why have your members joined the Eagles?
5 out of 6 of their trustees want to sell the property. And
right.
Those trustees have been members for many years, some of them 20 years. And why wouldn't people want parking in Ballard? There's a parking crisis in Ballard. They need this sale. They need to get that property cleaned up. I'm offering way more money than that property's worth, and everyone says that. Even James Forget doesn't say that I'm offering a low-ball offer. This offer, it's polluted. It's going to take $500,000 to $1 million to clean it up. And we have to pay for that. And the Eagles are going to get a large, $2.4 million that they can put into bonds and get a better return on their investment.
And there are members and trustees who agree with you. Separate from that, though, why have your members actually become members of this social club? Is this inviting your Olympic Athletic Club members to join the Eagles Club? Is that a deliberate attempt to change this vote?
I don't need to change the vote. The vote was 5-6. 5 out of 6 of the trustees want to sell this property. This is a great deal for the Eagles.
But it is up to the full membership. So I'm just wondering. I just want to get you on the record. Are you attempting to influence the outcome of the full membership vote by inviting your athletic club members to become Eagles?
I'm trying to influence the entire membership of the Eagles because this is a good deal, and many of the people that they've recruited have switched sides after they've really heard the truth. There's a lot of new membership down there from both sides of this issue. Probably we aren't even going to win the vote because they've brought so many people into the club. But as a long-term Eagle member, I think it's great. I mean, some of those people, right, are not going to stay, but many of them we hope will stay in the Eagles and will continue to participate.
How welcome do you feel when you walk into the Eagles Club?
Extremely welcome.
What's the atmosphere of the club like from your point of view?
Since this has happened, it's gotten a lot busier, and it's a kick. It's fun. I mean, we're improving the Eagles. I mean, this is going to be a better club after this, no matter what.
Finally, Jim, ultimately, why do you think building this parking garage is a good thing?
Well, I think that everybody thinks that we need parking, and the city of Seattle is not going to do it. And we need parking in this community and in many communities. And that, I think you'd be up in the 90% on a survey of that.
And that's Jim Riggle, owner of Olympic Athletic Club. He says he is encouraging everybody in the Seattle community to join the Eagles Club and make up their own mind about this issue. Eagles Club members will vote on whether or not to sell this piece of land to Olympic Athletic Club at a meeting on February 6th. Imagine this. You get evicted from your rental unit in a prime neighborhood of Seattle. So you move. Soon afterward, you see your old address listed on a vacation rental site like Airbnb or VRBO. Your home, your former home, has been converted to a full-time short-term rental. Seattle City Council member Tim Burgess wants to minimize that scenario with some new rules on rentals. He and other council members are concerned about housing here getting even more expensive.
The concern is that some of these online platforms have caused individuals to take property that might be rented on a longer basis and convert it to these short-term rentals. And so rather than a homeowner occasionally renting out part or all of their home, they've turned into a commercial operation and basically taking long-term rental properties off the market.
What is the problem with that?
Well, we have a housing crisis in our city, and it's important that we have public policies that protect the housing that we have in our city. We don't want to turn into a city that just has short-term rentals.
I saw some data from Airbnb. They claim that almost 80% of Airbnb hosts live in the home that they're offering, and that Airbnb helps these people afford their housing costs. And that's a way to keep housing affordable. How would you distinguish between those?
And I think that data actually confirms the positive side of the short-term rentals that these online platforms like Airbnb allow people to tap into. That's the benefit. That's good news. The bad news is the 20% or so that are converting properties to permanent short-term rentals, and then they're not available for longer rent in a city. So some other cities around the United States have attempted to tackle this. Philadelphia, for example, makes a distinction between a home that is rented 90 days or less per year for short-term rentals versus those rented more than 90 days. And they attempt to regulate the more than 90-day category.
Does it matter whether an absentee owner of a, let's say, a VRBO rental, do your ideas depend on those people being basically big businesses? Because what if the rental is owned by a retired person who's this, you know, they're trying to get by, or a small business person? This is their source of income.
And I think that's an important distinction as well, whether it's owner-occupied or not, whether it's used a certain number of days or more a year. Those are factors that I think are very important to consider as we look at this issue.
Airbnb said when they released data on the Seattle market last month that they're committed to being constructive partners with policymakers. That'd be people like you. Are you planning to work with Airbnb on this proposal?
Yes. And they have been constructive partners in the discussions about this. So this is not an attempt to regulate them out of the market or any of the other online platforms that exist. This is just to make sure that we are aware of the impact of this this new approach and make sure we don't harm another really important public purpose, which is the availability of long-term rental housing in our city.
We've been talking about some regulations on online rentals of homes, but let's pull back here, City Council Member Tim Burgess. What is the bigger picture? What's the takeaway on this? What is this really about for you?
This is about protecting the long-term housing market in our city and to make sure that people can live in Seattle and can successfully rent properties. We don't want a situation where, because of technology and these new online platforms, our housing supply over time shifts to huge quantities being allocated to commercial short-term rental activity. That's a positive when it's owner-occupied and it's a certain number of days a year. It becomes a potential negative when it is not owner-occupied housing and its full-time use is short-term rentals. So this is a beginning of a conversation to see what kind of a problem is this and how can the city properly use its authority to make sure that the negatives don't happen while homeowners are able to take advantage of the positives that these online platforms provide them.
That's Tim Burgess, chair of the Seattle City Council's Committee on Affordable Housing, Neighborhoods, and Finance, and he's working on new limits on renting out your property on these vacation rental sites like Airbnb or VRBO. And you're listening to KUOW. And here we are talking about bringing homes off the market when demand is so high in the Seattle area. Here's about how high that might get. You're going to have 1 million new neighbors in the Puget Sound area by 2040. That's the estimate. So a question is, how are all of us going to get around? One of the people trying to answer that question is Peter Rogoff, the new CEO of Sound Transit. That's the transit agency in charge of light rail and commuter buses. And boy, do they have big plans this year, with new light rail stations set to open on Capitol Hill and Husky Stadium this spring, groundbreaking on the East Side light rail next month, and a $15 billion initiative on the ballot this fall. The new CEO, Peter Rogoff, told me what those billions of dollars could pay for.
Well, there's a lot of projects, as many as 100 that are currently being contemplated. There's expanded commuter rail service. There is expanding light rail north, south, east, and west. There's enhanced bus service, including longer distance and more frequent commuter bus routes. And there's also the great challenge of trying to get some of those bus routes out of traffic, which involves some capital investments, whether it's bus-only lanes. Opportunities for buses to sort of jump the queue at traffic lights and get signal priority to get a green light every time they come through, just to increase the efficiency of the system.
Well, let's talk about expanded light rail. What do you say to somebody in Burien or Des Moines who's not going to see a light rail stop, but they're part of that 3-county area? They're paying into Sound Transit through taxes and car tabs. What do you say to that person who might feel underserved for all this money?
Well, I think they want to look at what mobility in the entire region means for them, both for their commute, but also for the economic well-being of their community. Even if they don't commute, they've got a lot of friends and neighbors that do. Also, increasingly, let's remember that every passenger that has decided to board either a commuter rail or light rail train that day is one less car on the highway. There's going to be, we know from the census, 1 million more people in this region by 2040. And our transportation system here is already clogged to the gills. So with 1 million more people, are we going to plan for it, or are we going to be overwhelmed by it?
Let's talk about neighborhoods that will get a light rail stop. Sometimes a light rail station can really change a community. Could be very welcome development, could drive up prices, could force some people out. What role can Sound Transit play to ensure that transit investment is going to benefit everybody in a community?
Well, I think there's important partnerships that are already being made but can be expanded on with those local communities. One thing that this community does, which is frankly quite rare nationally, has a program in place called Orca Lift to provide low-income citizens effectively a lower transit fare. This is always a tension that transit systems put up with all the time. On the one hand, they need to make sure that transit fares are low enough that low-income citizens who really need the service can use it. On the other hand, they have to raise revenue to pay the bills. Having an opportunity to make sure that there's affordable fares for those who really need lower fares, while simultaneously having the ability to charge other people more to pay the bills, is a great benefit to a transit system. And Sound Transit, frankly, is a great innovator nationally in taking that on.
You know, it could be 15 years before all these light rail projects are done. What do you have to say to commuters sitting, listening to you in gridlock right now?
Well, two things. One, we are looking at some nearer term investments with our partners to improve commutes in the near term. The other thing that I'd tell those commuters is one of the things I really want to bring has not so much to do with money, but with time. There's been some really successful efforts to get all of the partners in a major project to sit down together to conspire on how they can do the project more quickly. Normally when you go through a very lengthy environmental review process and permitting process, it can take a great many years. And those are years that you don't have shovels in the ground. Those are years you're not providing the rail service that people want. Those are the years you're not necessarily getting people out of traffic. There are sort of new models emerging where everyone can sit down and commit to a schedule early and get shovels in the ground sooner to get these things done so we can get the improvements to the public sooner.
Can I pick your brain about the future? Because you're building, you're planning and investing in long-term projects. How do you think about the future of transportation? We're hearing about self-driving cars. They're on the way.
That's one example. I mean, there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built out to sort of fully facilitate self-driving cars. And self-driving cars are something we also need to be mindful in terms of who's getting the benefits. Is self-driving cars going to be something that benefits everyone or just the folks that can afford to replace a car with a new car?
Self-driving cars are not going to make rail obsolete. You're not building white elephants.
No, I don't think so. It's not going to work for people that don't own cars. In terms of the population growth that we're going to see, you know, people often fall into this trap of arguing that it's all about highways versus light rail versus heavy rail versus buses. And frankly, with a million more people coming in the next 40 years, we're going to need more of all of it.
There'll be enough frustration for everyone. Don't
exactly.
Worry.
That's right.
Peter Rogoff, new CEO of Sound Transit. Thanks for joining me.
No, thanks for having me.
You know, there was a time when King County had lots of public transportation, a lot of it on the water, which made sense. That's a feature of this region, right? We had a mosquito fleet, an armada of small boats that crisscrossed the Puget Sound in the early 20th century. The director of Seattle's Museum of History and Industry, Leonard Garfield, told Jeannie Andel what the mosquito fleet looked like in action.
You know, the mosquito fleet was a swarm of little steamers, little steamboats that plied the Puget Sound and Lake Washington all over the place 100 years ago. They were kind of noisy. They were kind of smoky. They were even a little bit irritating because you couldn't always count on the schedule or the service, but they were there all the time, and they really were characteristic of the Puget Sound.
So I'm living in the region. I'm living in the Puget Sound region. It's the early 20th century between World War I and World War II. How do I get on one of the mosquito fleet? How do I get on one of these boats?
You know, no matter where you live in the Puget Sound, whether it's a small town or it's Seattle, you pretty much go down to the waterfront. There's a pier there, there's a dock, and that's where you're going to find your mosquito fleet steamer. And it's going to take you to neighboring towns. It's going to take you across the sound to islands. It's going to take you down to Tacoma, up to Bellingham. The service was fairly regular. It wasn't always 100% predictable, but it was how you got around. The water was the highway.
You just described this as a pretty sweeping service, covering essentially everything surrounding, all of the land surrounding Puget Sound. I mean, specifically, what were some of the routes?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there were 2,500 steamboats plying the Puget Sound in that early 20th century over a period of years. The last one was in service in the 1930s, so it lasted a long time. The routes went from Olympia north to Seattle up to Bellingham. They went cross sound, so from Seattle to Vashon Island, from Seattle to Tacoma to Seattle. And then there was a whole swarm of steamers on Lake Washington as well. So you could go down to Leschi or Madison Park and end up in Kirkland. Hey, wouldn't that be fun? You could skip 520 altogether.
Who ran all of these boats? Who was in charge of this fleet of 2,500 boats?
Well, it was pretty much a cobbled together system. There were lots of people who owned boats and lots of people who ran them. It was a competitive system. They were vying for passengers. The fares would vary depending on what the traffic would bear. It was really free enterprise in its most pure form in many ways.
Were there any problems with a competitive free enterprise, multi-managed system of ferries? Like,
well,
this?
There were lots of challenges. If you tried to get somewhere, you had to make sure that the vessel you were waiting for was in operation. There were plenty of mechanical problems that challenged them. You know, steamers were much more predictable than sailboats because they didn't rely so much on wind or current. But they did have boilers that occasionally exploded, and the steamer would end up in the bottom of Puget Sound. So you had that to deal with. The rates were not regulated. They would vary from time to time. So that was somewhat unpredictable. Eventually, the government decided that, hey, this has to actually be a predictable, reliable transportation system. So the state came into the system and tried to organize things. And, of course, eventually we had the Washington State Ferry System.
What happened to the mosquito fleet? What happened to this?
Well, you know, as we grew and as automobiles became the primary form of transportation, we needed vessels that were large enough to carry many people in relatively heavy vehicles. We needed much more predictable service, and we needed rates that we could count on. And so the state stepped in, and by the early 1950s, the state took over what was left of the mosquito fleet and created a systemized, state-run, state-owned ferry system, which even to this day, of course, provides predictable, reliable, and affordable service. That wasn't always the case before the state came onto the scene. So that's what happened to the mosquito fleet. The swarm is there, but not nearly in the numbers that it was. But in some ways, when you think about the duck dodge that we enjoy in Lake Washington and Puget Sound, Lake Union, when you think of the Christmas ships, when you think of the opening day boat parades, that's where we see the swarm of vessels these days. A little reminder that once hundreds and hundreds of vessels were on our waters, carrying us and carrying all our things everywhere we needed to go all the time.
What do you think it was about the Seattle of the late 19th century and the early 20th century that it created this really widespread commuter ferry system?
Well, I think it says that we really, at our core, are a maritime community. You know, you have to remember that we are an area that is pockmarked by hills, surrounded by mountains, covered by dense forests. It wasn't really conducive to land transportation, at least initially. You had to get around on water. So all the settlements ended up right on the shoreline. The water became our highway, and the mosquito fleet became the transportation system of the day. And, you know, it worked really, really pretty well. When you think of a system starting in the 1850s and going up to the 1950s in essentially the same configuration, you have to acknowledge that that's a system that allowed us to grow and expand tremendously. And so it really had its merits.
Leonard Garfield, director of Seattle's Museum of History and Industry, MOHAI. He talked with Jeannie Yandel in September when the King County Council was talking about creating three passenger ferry routes across Lake Washington. In fact, she asked Garfield, are we heading toward more reliance on maritime transportation?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, I think as a community, we've decided that these massive engineering projects are valuable, they're important, but we also need those flexible alternatives. And frankly, ferry boats and small ferries are one of the answers. So to see the county become involved in that is in some ways going back to the future, because the county actually ran some ferries across Lake Washington back in the early 20th century. So I think it makes a lot of sense. It'll be interesting to see whether the passengers enjoy it as much as it seems that they did 100 years ago. You know, in the 1940s, even after the bridges were built, when the Lake Washington ferries were still running, a lot of people preferred the ferries. They just liked getting to work on the water. There was something about it that was relaxing, maybe a little romantic. I think it's a great solution, something we do need to look forward to.
Well, a King County Council committee will be reviewing the proposed new passenger ferry routes across Lake Washington coming up here on February 2nd. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.
It is 50 degrees in Seattle, and Bill, it is rainy.
Still? Man, it was raining seriously early today, and all day long. In fact, the puddles have now joined forces with ponds, and they're teaming up with lakes, and you can't see out your car window while you're merging. You can't merge because traffic has stopped because drivers can't see out their car windows, and there's standing water.
Yay!
No, the water's standing. Don't stand. Water, drain. Where are the drains? Your walk to the bus stop is wet. Your wait at the bus stop is wet. The seats of the bus are wet. The floor of the bus is slippery. The smells of the bus are vivid. Maybe your income depends on selling your Real Change newspaper to people who don't want to look up, much less slow down. Do you have a dry place to sleep? I-90 is closed for avalanche danger. Highway 2 is closed as well, and more rain is coming at times in the next week. Maybe some water is good for your garden, but not all water is good. And yet, some of us still like this sound. I mean, especially after this last year when the drops didn't plink, the snow didn't shush, and the forests didn't not burn. We've had non-rain, and it's not good. Maybe we're wired to like this sound. Right? I mean, this is the sound of crops growing. This is the sound of rivers running. And if it's falling on your roof, it means you have a roof. What about you? Is this sound torture? A lullaby? A memory?
The rain on my window makes me want to grab covers and curl up and go back to sleep. But no, I'll get up. I will put the coffee on. I will sludge through it.
When it first starts raining, it feels cleansing. It's kind of washing away all the crummy. And you know it's snowing in the mountains, and you know it's what makes the trees green. And but after a while, it gets really old, you know? You don't want to get out with your kids to the park. And driving is a pain in the butt, but springtime's coming.
That's a promise, right? Springtime is coming, Bernard?
We have That's
that
what
confirmed?
They tell us.
Okay.
I can't verify that.
Okay, fair enough. How does the rain make you feel? We'd like to hear your take. Maybe a story. Maybe it's making you think of a story right now. We're at 206-221-3663. Again, 206-221-3663. This is KUOW. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. There's a new Elway poll out indicating 65% of Washington state residents want to raise the smoking age. That's good news to State Representative Tina Orwall. She's sponsoring a bill that would raise the purchase age for tobacco and vaping products to 21. KUOW's David Hyde talked with Representative Orwall last month when she pre-introduced the bill. She said that smoking is deeply personal for her, in large part because both of her parents died from lung cancer.
You know, anyone that's lost anyone to lung cancer or any type of cancer, it's a horrific way to lose someone. And I also remember growing up and how hard it was for my parents. They were always trying to quit smoking. And it was a tough part of their journey. And as a mother of two young adults. I have a son who's 17 and a daughter who's 20. I don't want them to have this tough path. I don't want any kids in our state to have this kind of struggle with an addiction throughout their lifetime and really have these horrific diseases that we know are directly associated with tobacco.
As you say, so many people have been touched by this, and I think most of our listeners know all the multiple reasons why smoking is so bad, so such a terrible thing for people's health. But why raise the smoking age to 21? Why that age in particular? What is your thinking behind that?
Well, often what they find is there's two paths. One is the 13, 14, and 15-year-olds often ask a peer or older sibling to purchase these products for them. And that makes them more accessible. But they also find, you know, if someone's between the age of 15 and 17, they might be able to go and purchase because they look almost 18. But when you move any product up to 21, it's a lot harder for teenagers to go purchase it. There's a bigger threshold, and they often don't look old enough to purchase.
You know, a lot of the brain science research lately suggests that the brain doesn't fully mature actually until the age of 25, maybe even older in some cases. Why not make the age even higher? I mean, this stuff is poison.
You know, it is very toxic, and I think we balance those things out. We do think that the brains are susceptible. In fact, you know, nicotine, as you know, is probably one of the most addicted drugs we have. It compares to heroin and other drugs. I think we have this window. We know 9 out of 10 adults who are smokers started before the age of 21. And so we do think that's the key window to really focus on.
And other places have tried this. New York City, for example, mm-hmm. the state of Hawaii.
Yes.
What's the experience of those places been? What are you going to tell your colleagues this session?
Well, what we're finding is these cities that have done it first, 5 years in, they're seeing significant reductions in youth smoking. There's one city outside of Boston that had a 50% reduction rate. And those are the kind of impacts we want to see. And so New York, they've also had a reduction. I think it was a 25% reduction, if I recall. But again, over time, it's a very positive impact on youth smoking.
You've got a lot of arguments in favor of this, raising the smoking age up to 21 here in Washington State. What kind of support do you think you're going to get this session?
You know, I hope to get strong support. We introduced it last year, and I think there was a lot of legislators that cared about this issue. There's some hurdles, but I do believe we're building some momentum of support.
What's the hurdle?
Well, I think the hurdle could be a financial hit to our budgets. And though that should not stop us from doing what's good policy, we do have to figure out how to address the loss of revenue.
But we're spending money on the one hand to help people. We've got anti-smoking programs. We've got health care costs in the state. You're saying the lack of revenue or the loss of revenue from smoking taxes is a real concern?
Well, you know, it's a short-term concern, but you're right. When we look at the millions of dollars our state probably spends on actually treating these diseases, it's a small amount of money. We know in the United States, we lose about 1,300 people a day due to diseases related to smoking. And there's for every person that dies, there's 30 people being treated for some horrific illness related to smoking. And so our state, of course, and our society has so much to gain by people not smoking.
Democrat Tina Orwall represents the 33rd District in the Washington State House of Representatives. She told David Hyde she wants to raise the purchase age for tobacco and vaping products to 21. We'll keep following the debate on that. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke.